The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The U.S., you know, spends billions on what it calls cybersecurity, and lawmakers say it's still not enough. That's the development of defenses to keep hackers out of sensitive computer systems and the development of weapons as well. That's chunks of computer code and other things which take advantage of the deep vulnerabilities of computer operating systems. Those are the things that are always updating themselves on your phone and your laptop. Now, one such deep code hacking weapon is called Stuxnet, and you may have heard of it. It was developed by the NSA and Israel and some others jointly. It was reportedly used to disrupt Iranian nuclear systems back in 2010, and it's still around. But now a group calling itself the Shadow Brokers claims to have stolen a similar and potentially much more dangerous NSA software weapon, a piece of which has been publicly posted, and they are now hosting an auction online, a Bitcoin auction online, to release all of the files that they claim to have. Some of the NSA's most guarded files have most likely been compromised. True? False? We don't know the exact answer to that, but here to help us are Nick Weaver, researcher at the International Computer Science Institute, and Stephen Levy, editor-in-chief of Backchannel. Nick, Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Nick, all the hacker swagger aside and the sort of bad Russian-sounding texts that are coming from this group called Shadow Brokers, what can we make of the source and the significance of this?
Well, the source is playing total theater with the auction. I'll get into that later. But the content is real, and the message is real. The content is, we hacked a whole bunch of top-secret NSA tools. We don't know how they got them yet, but they're saying, hey, we got them. Hey, we want the whole world to know we got them. And the auction is a blind for a specific threat of, hey, there's a whole bunch of additional material we can release in a nanosecond.
So the assumption is the person who would buy this in the auction is the NSA, and it's more of a hostage situation than it is any kind of a commercial transaction.
The auction itself is actually a complete distraction. It's like, Bitcoin is so traceable, it's like asking to be paid in marked sequential new bills with a radio receiver on them. So the auction is entirely designed to distract from them distributing not one encrypted file, but two. One which they provided the password, which is all the firewall tools, and the other which is secret to the world, but everybody who downloaded the files got both. So all the shadow brokers need to do to release that file to the world is a single tweet.
Interesting. All right. So Stephen Levy, what would these strange tools do? They get into doors of computers that are undefended or difficult to defend.
Sure. They're hacking weapons. There are things that increase the powers and make them the superpowers of people who ordinarily would be, you know, moderately talented malfeasant hackers. They can make them into super hackers because, you know, they provide ways to get behind firewalls, or if you're behind a firewall, they allow you to get more access to everything within a firewall, like Snowden did. So it's a dangerous thing to be out in the world.
Nick, is this the ultimate hacking tool, something that stays in the computer and watches everything, but can also interface with hardware and cause it to, you know, spontaneously combust at your desk or destroy a printer or send an airplane down to the ground?
No. And in fact, actually, the tools themselves are more specialized than most run-of-the-mill hackers are interested in. What this was a toolkit specifically for a given scenario. That is, I've broken into an institution. I have control over the system administrator's computer, and now I want to truly control everything in the institution. There is a single choke point on the network, the firewall, and this was a whole bunch of tools designed for, I start at the sysadmin's computer, I take over the firewall, and once I take over the firewall, all the network traffic for the entire institution goes through my devices. I can spy on it. I can change things. I can use this to attack other computers in the institution. And so this, in terms of granting powers to other hackers, is not that big a deal. There's only really one exploit that isn't patched at this point that's of significance. It's more the message. The message is, this is code that should be never leave the NSA. So much of what's in the archive is stuff not that you use to attack other computers, but stuff that the NSA person uses to help him in the process. So this is the stuff that runs on NSA systems and is stuff that shouldn't leave the control of the NSA at all. So that's why this is so scary. It's the message. It's not the contents of the files. It's that the contents exist outside the NSA at all.
Well, or the him or hers that could be, I mean, in play here. I mean, there's a number of unknowns. What do you make of this Kaspersky Files company, which developed this ability to use the auto run element of the Microsoft operating system to engage and hack into a system through some sort of printer doorway?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Do you know about this Kaspersky Labs?
Yes, they're a very reputable security firm in Russia. They're basically the Russian equivalent of Symantec. And they, like Symantec and like F-Secure, do a lot of work on discovering vulnerabilities and, more importantly for this, discovering the traces of attackers. So they're the ones that actually coined the term equation group to describe the NSA hacking tools that they saw on target systems.
The Kaspersky group that he's talking about, is it an oxymoron to say a reputable computer security firm in Russia?
Oh, well, it is very reputable.
Well, that's fine, but I'm just going to get Stephen's assessment here.
Yeah, there's this gray area that these places get on. I mean, this, to me, you know, Nick is right that it isn't so much the any immediate threat from the stuff in these encrypted files that, and then now the unencrypted one, which is, you know, dangerous to us. It is underlying the big mess that we're in cybersecurity there. And the fact that the NSA, you know, has, you know, all these, you know, 0-day exploits, which means, you know, the first time vulnerabilities that the manufacturer of the software hasn't had an opportunity to fix, underlines the difficulty we have there is when we have the system with a lot of vulnerabilities. And many governments, not just ours, but the Chinese, the North Koreans, the Russians, and then there's private hacking groups. They find out these vulnerabilities, and they attack us there. So you would think that, gee, if our government finds these vulnerabilities, that's a national security issue too, to make U.S. citizens vulnerable, to allow them to be vulnerable. Because there's these flaws that can be attacked there. But instead, what happens is when the NSA discovers a flaw, it's like finding an Easter egg in a game. They say, wow, we have this thing now, and we can use it to exploit the systems ourselves. And they sit on these vulnerabilities, but it isn't just the NSA that can use them. It's other groups, other countries, and other groups.
These are tools that are really hard to exploit. You have to be in the right position in a target's network. But they're very powerful when you do, and it's easy to write the exploits because the vulnerabilities are incredibly stupid. So under normal circumstances, I could actually see the NSA going, oh, this Cisco vulnerability, I don't want to release it to Cisco because it's more useful for me, and we hope that nobody else discovers it. The real question is, back in 2013, when the NSA lost all this data, the question is, did the NSA know about it? If the NSA knew about it and didn't tell Cisco, that's very bad, because it means that the NSA, after knowing that a hostile actor has access to the same exploit, didn't notify a U.S. company that greatly affects U.S. security.
So,
if the NSA didn't know about this, this means that somewhere 3 months after Snowden went public and they were in the most defensive mode altogether, somebody was able to walk out with 300 megabytes of stuff.
Of even more dangerous stuff. Yes. In that, in the post-Snowden moment there. Well, Nick Weaver and Stephen Levy, we don't have any more time, but is the barn on fire and the doors are open and the horses have already escaped? I mean, is this a moment that we cannot go back in time except, you know, in the Matrix, Stephen?
I think that we have to go in a different direction in order to secure ourselves, because we're in, you know, a wildly vulnerable situation there. And the government, I think our government, is concentrated too much on offense and not enough on defense.
Nick?
I think that it's a bit more complicated. But one thing that this tells me is that the security vendors themselves, the firewall vendors themselves, are writing horrid code that's supposed to defend us. So the firewall vulnerability in the Cisco product is so stupid and basic, you teach it to undergrads.
So firewall made out of paper.
Yes, literally. It's a firewall with a blunder that we knew shouldn't have been done 30 years ago.
Nick Weaver is a researcher at the International Computer Science Institute, speaking to us from Berkeley, California. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
And Stephen Levy is editor-in-chief of Backchannel. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
In the city above ground in the summer, human activity, asphalt, and concrete generate, hold, and store heat long after the sun sets. New York City's temperatures, for instance, are significantly warmer day and night than the surrounding regions. It's easy to create policies based on the temperature outside, like when to open a cooling center or issue air quality alerts. But what about the indoor temperature? How does extreme heat inside our homes impact health when access to an air conditioner isn't an option? Our co-producer, WNYC, has launched the Harlem Heat Project to try and find out. Reporter Sarah Gonzalez says preliminary data show what you would expect, so the Gonzalez team is pushing to know more.
Our preliminary data shows that it's reaching 90 degrees and at times 95 degrees, surpassing 95 degrees inside of the homes of Harlem residents. And we found that when the temperatures drop outdoors, so late at night, early in the morning, when it sort of gets cooler outside, we found that the temperatures are not dropping inside. So it could be 65, 70 degrees outside at night, and it's still in the 90s inside of these people's homes, which means that they basically have no relief. Public health professionals say air conditioning in the summer, for some people, really does need to be treated the way heat is in the winter, which is essentially free. I mean, it's included in their rent.
You spoke with a doctor who really sees heat as a public health issue in precisely this neighborhood and in exactly the places that you've installed these sensors. What does she say?
So Dr. Anar Shah works in the emergency room at Mount Sinai Hospital in Harlem. And she says in a week she might see 10 patients who are affected by extreme heat in the summer. So maybe that's not the primary reason why they come in. They're not coming in complaining about the heat specifically, but it plays a role in their ailments.
I don't know why people don't take it as seriously. I think that it's not as obvious when you look outside your window that there is something dangerous that is happening in the environment.
What she's describing is really what you're trying to unpack in this project. Everything happens indoors. The heat danger happens indoors. The population is inclined to endure and not talk about what it is they're enduring, and the symptoms accumulate, and then we get the deaths, which are very, very hard to track. How do you track them?
The only sure way that you know whether or not somebody died from heat, so from hyperthermia, is if you take their body temperature right before they die, and their body temperature is around 104 degrees. So obviously, the only time you would have that person's body temperature is if they were already in the hospital and the hospital is you know, getting that information. But when people are inside of their homes and they die inside of their homes, it becomes like a largely subjective process.
How unexpected is something like heat stroke? And did you talk with anyone who actually experienced these symptoms?
I spent some time in the emergency room at Mount Sinai Hospital in Harlem after a string of 90-plus degree days, and the ER was just packed. There are patients in the hallways everywhere. You could barely walk through it. Not all of them came in for heat or because of the heat. But the doctors there said that during heat waves and during the summer months, they ask, do you have air conditioning? Have you been using it consistently? Do you have access to water? Have you been drinking water? Because they know that it does play a role. And so when I was there, I spoke to a 69-year-old woman, and she had just been admitted for heat exhaustion. She lives on the fifth floor in Harlem with no AC.
I couldn't deal with heat. I couldn't. It was too hot for me, and then I feel weak. Then later on, then I start, my head starts to hurt, and then I start to throw up, and I feel a little dizzy.
Those are the classic symptoms right there.
Right, and you know, she's 69, so she's not on the extreme end of age there, but she has a lot of medical conditions. She has a stomach problem. One of the things that I heard from some public health professionals was that maybe for people like Helen, we should be treating air conditioning as like a prescription, like a doctor could prescribe, like Helen definitely needs air conditioning because it's affecting her health.
And this is sort of a judgment that is called into the conversation you had with Eric Kleinenberg.
He's a sociologist at New York University, and he's written a lot about heat and Americans' overuse of AC, but also how AC is actually necessary for some people.
Air conditioning is a luxury and not a necessity almost all of the time. But there are times in our hot and humid summers when air conditioning can make the difference between life and death. And I say that as someone who is very critical of Americans' overuse of air conditioning.
So we need to think about, in summers of extreme temperatures, the idea of air conditioning as an entitlement for individuals who are in danger, wherever they are in the socioeconomic part of our community. That's something we really need to develop.
Right. And so what we're hoping to get out of all of our heat sensors is just a sense of what kind of problem this actually is for some people. What health professionals say, the data that they collect, that they give to the health department, that determines all sorts of policies, like when cooling centers open, when cooling centers close. We know that indoor temperatures has helped influence policy that says residents need heat in the winter. And so if we know how hot it actually is getting inside of these homes, at least there will be some record that might be able to influence some policy.
Sarah Gonzalez, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Gonzalez is a reporter for our co-producer, WNYC. Another record, not from Rio, though. July was the hottest month on record, putting 2016 to be the hottest year ever recorded, according to NASA. How do you cope with the heat? Austin, Texas, this year it's easy. I'm sitting outside where it would normally be 100 degrees, and it's 78 degrees and rainy.
My name is Janice, and I'm from the hot South, so I try not to be outdoors in the middle of the day. I plan my life around moving around outside early in the morning and late in the evening.
Hi, this is Mona from Wellington, Florida. Hard to tell, really, as far as dog days of summer go. We have them 6 months out of the year. I keep cool by swimming. Every day I swim, and there's this thing called AC. It's everywhere down here, simply everywhere. So all you have to do is walk fast from your car to the grocery store, to the mall, to the pool, to your home, to the theater. That's all you have to do.
You go, Mona. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
It is men who are in U.S. prisons mostly, but today, women are the fastest growing segment of inmates in this system, primarily designed for men. The Vera Institute of Justice and the Safety and Justice Challenge found in a new report that the number of women behind bars has increased 14-fold in a little over four decades, with approximately 110,000 women now incarcerated. It's a predominantly African-American and Hispanic population. Most are poor. Nearly 80% are mothers, and 22% have serious mental illness, which is double the rate of jailed men. Most are incarcerated for low-level, nonviolent crimes, often committed to support a drug habit or addiction. The Vera Institute study finds that jails are ill-equipped to deal with the challenges of women in the justice system. And that's the experience of former inmate Renia Angel Farmer, an exceptional case. She's seen it all. Now she's a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start, a program dedicated to assisting women in transition from prison life to society in St. Louis, Missouri. Renia, welcome.
Hello.
110,000 women are incarcerated today, and I suspect that almost all of them have family issues of one kind or another, specialized health issues that the prison was not originally designed to serve. How badly does the criminal justice system fall short in some of these categories?
It falls short, definitely, number one, in the medical field. They hire doctors who have got fired from their practices from the outside, and they come in, continue to work as a fired doctor to try to help inmates. And you literally, I've seen a lot of women die literally at my feet due to lack of knowledge, due to just not caring. And you literally got to be half dead to even get a ride to the hospital, you know, put it like that. They try to do everything right in that little vicinity that they have with a minimal amount of work or tools that they need. And it's just not healthy at all.
What about family issues, women with children, women who even find themselves pregnant at the time of incarceration?
Well, if they're pregnant, God help them. They're literally got to be like 7 or 8 centimeter, you know, dilation before they even take them out of the building. But they still have to sleep on the same steel bunk beds, things like that. But as far as those of us with children there, the program Let's Start, when I was there, they helped a lot in bringing my children from St. Louis all the way up to Vandalia, a 2-hour drive, so that I can have these visits with my children, because my family wasn't traveling that far. They figured, hey, you made that bed, lay in it. And I get it. I understand it. But had it not been for Let's Start, I wouldn't have saw my children or my pastor.
Do you think nationally the criminal justice system is ready for this 14-fold increase in 4 decades and the continuing increase in women inmates and all of the issues that you've described here that increase brings?
They're not ready and they're not equipped. They don't have enough staff for that. You only have to have a 8th grade education to work in the prison system. Some of them are intimidated by those who have college degrees, and that can cause a targeting in the prison system. I've seen that. How smart you are and how smart they aren't, you know, could cause a problem. But because they carry the badge, then there's a constant confrontation right there.
What do you think the impact of mental illness is among the female prison population? And are the facilities that you know about and have experience with come close to dealing with that?
They don't deal with the mental population, I believe. The women that I've seen, they're more medicated than dealt with. They'll come in and I've went and talk to some of these people. I pretty much was curious about what was going on, because I wanted to find out about PTSD, wanted to find out about schizophrenia affective and major depression. These aren't things that we talked about in a quote-unquote black household, but these were things that were taking place, and so I needed to know, I needed a root definition of what was going on, what was needed, what needed to be done. And the prison system, it definitely wasn't. You may, out of 10, you may have 1, maybe 2 people that were qualified to kind of help you, and all they can do is talk. But mostly they medicate them. They would rather medicate them to keep from pretty much dealing with them. And so I watch a lot of women walk around not even knowing that there is an existence, because they're so medicated. And that's not a healthy help. You know, they put these labels on them, these mental labels on them. And yes, they are true, but there has to be something more than just blocking them out.
You are a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start. You're an activist for the prison population that you were once a part of. And clearly you've taken steps to begin a life outside of prison. But in general, what is the American population going to receive back into communities from what's being done or not done with the inmates that you see in this growing female inmate population?
Some do go in and come out without, you know, having to go back down that road. Some, it takes 5, 6, 7, 8 times going back and forth. But most of it is definitely a mindset. You said, hey, I'm going to come home. I'm going to be the best person I can be. I'm not going to live up to the standards that, you know, if you're told you'll never be nothing, you'll never amount to anything, you'll start to believe that. But until you change how you think, that's a part of keeping you one step out of the penitentiary.
Rania Farmer, can I call you Angel?
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much. Angel Farmer is a speaker and facilitator at Let's Start in St. Louis, Missouri. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later this hour, we will learn about research into another possible government secret, super brainy, visually acute super recognizers whose brains can make out faces from grainy satellite photos even. We go now to the NSA Situation Room deep in the Pentagon. Recognizer team, what have you got?
Nothing yet.
Is it him?
Is that PB Herman? Neil Patrick Harris?
Come on, folks, we caught a break here. Let's go.
Nothing yet, Chief.
Hey, what's with all the celebrities? Where did you come from, anyway? Paparazzi. I used to work at Ibiza back in the day.
Well, stick to suspects, okay? Jason Bourne. That's the target.
I want Bourne in a body bag by sundown.
Okay. I've got Sarah Palin on the tarmac in Berlin.
What are you, nuts? Nobody cares about Sarah Palin. You're gonna get us fired.
I can't help it. I recognized her. Sorry, false alarm. It's just Tina Fey. Sorry. So, I'm looking for a kind of Jeremy Renner type, I guess.
Hey, CERT police are looking for an American man carrying a red bank bag.
He just tore up the embassy and he put two cops in the hospital last night.
That's gotta be Bourne. Super recognizer team on it.
Keep going. There, wait.
Wait a minute, guys. I know that face. I know it. Guys, I've got it. There he is. Forget this Bourne fellow. That's Matt Damon.
Matt Damon, you are completely useless.
Forget it.
Super recognizers are people with extremely good facial recognition abilities, and their brain talents were only identified in 2009 when researchers conducted a study on facial recognition. For a while, we've known that people can have facial blindness from a brain injury, but the super recognition talent occurs in about 1 in 50 people. Now, London's Metropolitan Police Service has created a super recognizer unit to identify criminals caught on webcams and closed-circuit TV eyes. Richard Russell is a psychology professor at Gettysburg College, and he helped identify the condition back in 2009.
It's certainly a visual process. It involves looking at a visual image or the light bouncing off of a particular person's face and then connecting that visual pattern to stored memories of people that you've seen before.
So super recognizers, what do they used to do? Work for like the National Enquirer, picking out celebrities in Hollywood?
Unfortunately, they are really not employed in any special ways. The one exception to that is the London Police that's put together a unit of super recognizers. But I think because until very recently, we didn't know that people differed in how good they were at recognizing faces. And so we haven't even yet begun to see the application of this.
And part of the recognizer revelation comes from the fact that there is something called facial blindness or face blindness.
Yes, that was really critical, I think, in discovering super recognizers, because we had known for quite a long time that some people were bad at recognizing faces if they had some kind of specific brain damage. It first became apparent maybe around 15 to 20 years ago that it's quite common for people to be bad at face recognition, and they're just born that way, as far as we can tell, or in any event, they never develop normal face recognition abilities. And I think that discovering that some people were really bad at recognizing faces helped, you know, suggest to people like me and my collaborators that maybe some people were the opposite.
What do you think is the application of learning more about the brain in this regard in terms of possible, you know, visual software and even the use of super recognizers in some security application?
Well, I think that the first thing really is that this is just kind of uncharted territory. The fact that we're seeing the world differently than each other, even though we're not aware of it, suggests that really there's kind of a lot to learn still just about how the brain works, how each of us is experiencing life. And so I think, you know, we don't even yet know what the possible applications of this are. But a couple that spring to mind immediately are, you know, use in security fields. Anytime someone is checking an ID card, probably it would be better if that was someone who is relatively good at recognizing faces instead of relatively bad. At the moment, there really is no screening mechanism for this. So that's one area. Another is this super recognizer unit in London has, you know, proved to be quite useful for apprehending people who are believed to have committed crimes. And, you know, I think a possible third area might relate to eyewitness testimony. Our legal system places quite a bit of weight on the eyewitness testimony and in criminal proceedings. And I think that it might be useful to understand that that ability varies from one person to the next. You know, let's say if you have a gun pointed at you, it turns out that people tend to just look at the gun and they're freaked out by that and they don't really notice the person who's holding it. But this work really suggests that, let's say, the victim or the person who's witnessing the event, they're bringing their own personal abilities to that occasion. And it might be useful to know, is this someone who's really good at recognizing faces? Or are they really bad? That might be a kind of a factor that we would want to consider when evaluating their eyewitness testimony.
And you published your paper, or you and your team published the paper in 2009. What's happened since then?
Well, there's been an increase in the number of labs starting to study super recognizers. There are really a lot of questions that, you know, we still don't know about them. You know, what other kinds of things are they good at or not good at? How might their brains be different? Or is there a genetic component? These are the kinds of questions that people are starting to address now.
Richard Russell is psychology professor at Gettysburg College. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
More and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
My favorite thing about the ocean is the sound of the waves.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
Go to the beach and fly my kite and go on the boardwalk.
The more science we do, the bigger this problem appears.
If we don't conserve the oceans, it would be really terrible.
It'd be super heartbreaking.
Unfathomable to me.
It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
As we finish up our series on humans' impact on our oceans, something we're calling Trashing the High Seas, we take you to the premier ecosystem of the underwater world. Day and night, whales, fish, and other species are singing, using their sounds, grunts, whistles, drumming, echolocation to forage, to find mates, to avoid predators. We don't even know what a lot of these songs are for. But there are hecklers in this venue. The industrial, intrusive noises of drilling rigs, boats, explosives. Humans are rude planet-scale hecklers, endangering marine life under the oceans. And to address this, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, released the Ocean Noise Strategy Roadmap, calling for more research on the impact of these sounds, calling for outreach to other governmental, military, and environmental and industry groups. And they're also building a gigantic robot bouncer to kick the noisy humans out of the oceans. Actually, I'm lying about the bouncer, but Michael Jasny, director of the Marine Mammal Protection Project and the Land and Wildlife Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, would love to be a bouncer for the oceans. But for now, sounding the alarm before it's too late will just have to do.
The impacts range from suppression of bioirrigation in clams and other invertebrates that lie on the ocean floor to producing hearing loss in fish, to reducing eels' ability to respond to predators, to silencing whales over vast areas of ocean. It's just a remarkable a range of impacts, and indeed all the way to acute injury and death from some sound sources.
So what kind of strategy can you use to create a map that will produce policy that can actually make a dent in this ocean noise and possibly turn it around?
I think the two main kinds of mitigation that need to be done are, one, keeping loud sources of noise out of biologically important habitat. So identifying habitat that is important to protect for a diversity of marine species, and then keeping military training, oil and gas activities, and to the extent possible, you know, rerouting ships around those areas. The second important thing is to reduce the amount of sound that goes into the water. And one way to do this, use technology, often a solution to our environmental ills. It's also very relevant here. We know, for example, that ships can be significantly quieter than they are today. The estimates I've seen is that it ought to be pretty easily doable to reduce noise from ships by something like 90% of what it is today. And there are other technologies on the horizon for oil and gas exploration can significantly reduce noise there. There are technologies available for offshore construction, pile driving to reduce noise from that activity. There's a lot of possibilities out there, but you know, we need to have the political will to seize them.
And let's talk about the politics for a moment. The federal court has ruled that the U.S. Navy wrongly used sonar that could harm whales and other marine life. It seems like there are already legal precedents for regulating noise. The U.S. Navy was apparently wrongly granted a permit in 2012 to use its training, testing, and routine operational sonar. Is that good news to you? I suspect it is.
Yeah, it is, and it's an important decision. What that decision says, among other things, is that where there is scientific uncertainty, you know, you want more data than you have, it is better to, and the law requires, that you err on the side of overprotection rather than underprotection. And what we've seen in the past is that the agency has done exactly the opposite, in that instead of taking the standards for management that are in our marine mammal protection law, and that make it the leading statute for marine mammal protection probably on the planet, the agency has too often just issued blank checks to applicants like the U.S. Navy, like the oil and gas industry. And hopefully this decision can help turn things around.
Is the government along with this? Is this a private initiative? Just what's the coalition here trying to make this happen? I mean, I know you're at the NRDC.
One of the most encouraging things to have emerged on this issue in the past couple of years is something called an ocean noise strategy. The Obama administration has been developing the strategy over the last few years and finally in early June released it. And what it says is that the rise in chronic cumulative ocean noise poses a real concern for marine species and the marine ecosystem, that the government needs to take affirmative, progressive steps in coping with the problem. And it needs to marshal all of its existing authorities, not only under our marine mammal protection law, our endangered species legislation, but every other authority that it has, national marine sanctuaries, coastal zone management, and bring them together in a concerted effort to really get at this problem of rising cumulative noise in the ocean. It's a great first step.
Would you say, finally, that there's a species die out because of noise, that there's a particularly devastated part of the ocean that's just so noisy it won't support any sort of life anymore?
There have been a number of cases where noise has been having population-level effects, in some cases devastating effects, particular populations, well-studied populations of marine mammals, some beaked-whale populations, some dolphin populations as well. The scary thing is that, you know, the more science we do, the bigger and bigger this problem appears. And we believe it's time that the government take the kind of concerted action that it has proposed to rein in a problem that is affecting diversity of marine life and ultimately through impacts on fishing, on tourism, on all the ways in which we interact with the sea will affect us as well.
Michael Jasny is director of the Marine Mammal Protection Project for the National Resources Defense Council. Michael, thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, John.
To stay up to date with our full series on the oceans, head over to thetakeaway.org/oceans.
This is Dee Dee from San Francisco. I grew up in Colorado, a long way away from the ocean, but I went to the University of Hawaii for a year. That experience of living on an island in a culture very different from mine changed my life and view of the world.
We're looking for Dee Dee's stories. We're looking for your ocean stories. What's the ocean mean to you? Come on, give us your best romantic, nostalgic reflection. Portland, Oregon. I was raised in a small coastal town betwixt Santa Barbara and Monterey, bathed in cold light from low clouds. There is and always will be nothing better for the soul than coastal fog. It almost rhymes. What's the state of the ocean where you live? It's your favorite ocean memories. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Send us a voice memo, takeawaydigital@gmail.com. Comment at thetakeaway.org. That's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry.